My dear brothers and sisters, and our older young people, last night Brother Nick left us with the thoughts of those that feared Yahweh and thought upon his name. We read in verse 17 of chapter 3, "They shall be mine, saith Yahweh of hosts, in that day when I make up my jewels, and I will spare them as a man spareth his own soul that serveth him. Then shall ye return and discern between the righteous and the wicked, between him that serveth God and him that serveth him not." And this discernment is necessary because verse 1 of chapter 4 begins with the word "for." And that's a very important connecting word which brings together the thoughts of the end of chapter 3 with the beginning of chapter 4. Now, as we look at chapter 4, which has our attention for this morning, we're going to see that idea of thought, which Brother Nick said has a root in the word "weave," and he took us back to Exodus. We're going to see the work of Elijah in the future laid out for us in the word of the prophets, as it were, woven into the text. Not necessarily that clear on a surface read, but we're going to see it there. As we see this work of restoration being the complete opposite of the judgment that is now coming and foretold in verse 1 of this chapter. "For behold, the day cometh that shall burn as an oven, and all the proud, yea, and all that do wickedly shall be stubble in that day." Now, we have then, in this final chapter of Malachi, six short verses. It's the very end of the Old Testament, and it brings together a complete summary of Malachi, and a summary, if you like, of the whole of the ending of the whole of the Old Testament. And we have, basically, two principles revealed to us. In verses 1 to 3, the judgment of the wicked, and in verses 4 to 6, the restoration of Israel. And that will be the consummation of the purpose of Yahweh. There's only two options here: the judgment of the wicked or the restoration of Israel. We can only be in one of those two camps. And of course, our life now is choosing which one we wish to be in, because we have free will to do God's will or not. For his purpose to fill this earth with his glory will be fulfilled, as we read in Habakkuk 2, verse 14. The just shall live by faith. And so we have the whole purpose of God revealed to us in Genesis to Malachi, that his purpose will be fulfilled. And the New Testament then shows us how we can only access that through faith in Christ Jesus. And that shows us how we can be part of it. Before that purpose can be fulfilled then, we have this judgment in verse 1. And just a few words of absolute power and purpose that will envelop the wicked. Our God is a consuming fire, and those who oppose him will feel it. In verse 15 of chapter 3, it spoke about those, the wicked, who were proud. Well, they're not so happy now as the judgments unfold and the fire of God's judgments will be felt upon the wicked. The oven that we read of here is translated elsewhere as furnace. It will burn hot. And the stubble, they are as stubble, and they will be completely consumed. It talks about root and branch here, and that's a phrase that we've become accustomed to basically mean the whole thing. Nothing at all is left. If there's a root and branch review of something, it's right from head to toe. Everything is included. And so when the destruction comes upon the wicked, root and branch, there is nothing that is left. Come with me back to Isaiah chapter 5, where we think these words have their origin. Isaiah and chapter 5. Now, this chapter signifies Israel as a vine, as a choice vineyard. And it has its roots, or parable of the vineyard that Jesus gave has its roots also in this chapter. As they were hedged about, and the perfect scenario for producing fruit, and yet something was wrong because they brought forth, in verse 4, wild grapes. The whole production cycle in the vineyard was completely mixed up. And we read in verse 20, "Woe unto them that call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for light and light for darkness, and that put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe unto them that are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight." This is the class of people we've been thinking about this weekend. Those who self-justify, who have drifted away from God's word. A complete mixed up world is being spoken about here. They call evil good and good evil. It's turned on its head, verse 23, "which justify the wicked for reward and take away the righteousness of the righteous from him. Therefore, as the fire devoureth the stubble and the flame consumeth the chaff, so their root shall be as rottenness, and their blossom shall go up as dust, because they have cast away the law of Yahweh of armies, and despised the word of the Holy One of Israel." This is the end of those who despise the word of Yahweh, the law of his word, the Holy One of Israel. And despise there means to treat with contempt, to make light of. It's not important enough to change the way that we want to do things. And for those people, destruction was coming. But for the rest, those that thought upon the name of Yahweh, was woven into their minds, they respect his word, there is a far better option awaiting for them as the Son of Righteousness arises with healing in his wings. We read in verse 2, "But unto you that fear my name shall the Son of Righteousness arise with healing in his wings. And ye shall go forth and grow up as calves of the stall." We're reminded every day of the need for the healing rays of this beam of sunshine, which is a beautiful depiction of the work of Christ when he returns. That word wings means extremities, and it's sometimes used and referred to as the warm rays that extend forth from the sun. And it shows the reach of the Son of God when he returns and the healing that he will bring. Ultimately, of course, the healing of sin. It's a beautiful picture that signals the end of a long, dark Gentile night when the evil of man's perverse ways will be replaced with judgment, justice, righteousness and mercy. He brings with him a crown of righteousness that will be given to all them that love his appearing. And this then will be the light to fill the earth. Arise and shine, for thy light is come, and the glory of Yahweh is risen upon thee. For behold, the darkness shall cover the earth, and gross darkness the people, but Yahweh shall arise upon thee, and his glory shall be seen upon thee. And the Gentiles shall come to thy light, and kings to the brightness of thy rising. That's Isaiah 60, verses 1 to 3. Those that fear his name, we read, will be calves of the stall. That means healthy, strong, and well cared for. Treading down the wicked, in verse 3, with the soles of their feet. We have to go to Micah and chapter 4 just to pick up these thoughts, because all of these thoughts are found in the rest of the Old Testament, as we have almost a summary of this judgment and restoration that is coming, that has been spoken of by the prophets right from the beginning. And Micah chapter 4 then speaks of the time when all nations will be gathered together against Jerusalem, of that time when Christ and the saints will go forth to liberate the people of Yahweh and the city of his choosing. Verse 11 of chapter 4 of Micah. Now also many nations are gathered against thee, and say, let her be defiled, and let our eye look upon Zion. But they know not the thoughts of Yahweh, neither understand they his counsel. For he shall gather them as the sheaves into the floor. Arise and thresh, O daughter of Zion, for I will make thine horn iron, and I will make thy hooves brass. And thou shalt beat in pieces many people, and I will consecrate their gain unto Yahweh, and their substance unto the Lord of the whole earth. This destruction of the wicked will not be resistible. Psalm 149 says, this honor hath all his saints. If we just go back to Malachi 4 and think about that verse we've just read, there's a very interesting way in which it's laid out, and we've seen this already this weekend. Ye shall tread down the wicked, for they shall be ashes under the soles of your feet in the day that I shall do this, saith Yahweh of hosts. This is the purpose of God being fulfilled by a multitude of saints. We call this God manifestation, where a person or body or people evidence the character of Yahweh doing his will. Jesus said in John 17, I have manifested thy name. And by that, he meant that those who knew him also knew the name of the Father, because it was visible and evident in his life. He did his Father's will and showed forth his character, a character of mercy and grace, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth. One God perfectly seen in a multitude of those who fear his name. And here they are doing his will. The name here is Yahweh of armies, the Lord of hosts. We mentioned this yesterday. And the Hebrew is Yahweh Sabaoth. And it's transliterated in Romans 9, verse 29. And by that we mean the word is lifted into the English without translation, where it says the Lord of Sabaoth in Romans 9, verse 29. It's a mighty army. It's emphasizing a time of judgment. And this, there are 24 occasions when that is used in Malachi, emphasizing this message of judgment that is coming upon the wicked. But where we read the Lord of hosts, Yahweh of hosts, it means the military title of God, Yahweh of armies. He who will be the head of a great army. And so after this time of judgment, which we've very quickly covered in verses 1 to 3, there is a positive follow-on, which is a time of restoration. And it's summarized in these last three verses of the Old Testament. It's the very last paragraph of the Old Testament. And there's immediately an appeal. And it takes us right back to the Exodus. Remember ye the law of Moses, my prophet, my servant, which I commanded unto him in Horeb for all Israel with the statutes and judgments. So let's just remember here, all Israel, the whole of Israel. Okay, they were assembled at Horeb, and this should have sent a tingle down their spine as they remembered how the ground shook at Horeb, a recollection of the awesome presence of Yahweh, their fear, the shaking of the ground. This should have had an impact upon them, but it seems in the day of Malachi, they were so hardened and so impervious, nothing would penetrate through, and it made no difference. And this restoration, in verse 5, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of Yahweh, and he shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to the fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. So we'd like to spend the rest of our time together looking at the role of Elijah in the age to come and this restoration, which is a beautiful theme, a positive end to some of the difficult things we've been considering over this weekend and the challenges that faced God's people in the days of Malachi. We've had a look at John the Baptist, especially last night in Brother Nick's work, and it's interesting for us to consider the thought that says, well, John was Elijah. He was the messenger. He came in the days of Jesus. He was the forerunner. Well, he was all of those things, of course. But when he was asked, art thou Elijah? He said, I am not. Art thou that prophet? No. That's the testimony of John. He was not Elijah, and that's John 1 and verse 21. Well, let's have a look at what his work was to be. To turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the heart of the children to the fathers. Now, if Malachi has a parallel with the latter days, and it is effectively taking us into the future. We looked at that second coming of Nehemiah, similar to the second advent of Christ, and the ultimate fulfillment of God's purpose, and the Son of Righteousness arising, and the kingdom being established, and the judgment of the wicked, and then the work of Elijah is here. So it is projecting us into the future for a work that we have not yet seen, or that has not yet been fulfilled, although we have seen it in type. Now, when we look at that verse, Malachi 4, verse 6, it's quoted in Luke 1, verse 17. We did look at it yesterday. He shall turn the heart of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to the fathers. Well, in Luke 1, it's changed to turn the hearts of the fathers of the children and the disobedient to the wisdom of the just. That gives us a slightly clearer picture as to what is being intended by the work of Elijah. The disobedient to the wisdom of the just. And that makes sense in what we've been seeing in Malachi with the disobedience of the people. And so this Luke 1:17 is obviously talking about John, because that was the prophetic word that was spoken at the time just before his birth, when it was spoken of the work that he would do. It shows the work of the forerunner, but it wasn't fulfilled in John's day. And it wasn't fulfilled in the first days of Elijah, in his first advent. Because the people as a whole didn't respond. There was no turning of the hearts of Israel. It foreshadows the work of Elijah yet to come. The regathering and conversion of disobedient Israel, which is the sum of the work of all the prophets. The work of restoration. He will restore all things. Mark 9, verse 12. And that was spoken after the death of John, after the transfiguration, when Elijah had appeared alongside Moses and Jesus. He will restore all things. So there's work to be done. And when is this work to be done? It says, before the great and dreadful day of Yahweh. That's in verse 5. Well, when is that day? Well, there's 25 days of Yahweh in the Old Testament. Well, in the Scriptures, 25 days of the Lord. But there's only one other great and dreadful day, and that's in Joel 2, verse 11. And again, we saw it yesterday. Joel 2, verse 11. It actually says the great and terrible day. But it's exactly the same Hebrew word as we have here, great and dreadful day. So it's the same word. But Joel 2 is clearly talking about AD 70, which was a great and terrible day when the heavens and the earth shook and the end of Judah's commonwealth occurred. And prior to those days in AD 70, John the Baptist had come in the spirit and power of Elijah in those days as the forerunner to Christ. So we see that model being established, and that pattern of things that's happened first in order to show us what's going to happen into the future. Because every time we want to understand God's purpose in the future, we look to the past to see what's happened, because it's all laid out for us. We have a repeating pattern through the Scriptures, where we have the past being a shadow for the time of the end and the future. And we see Elijah's physical return to Israel commencing before the day of Armageddon, before that great and dreadful day, which was typified in AD 70, but will ultimately come when the northern invader comes down and there is a great battle to liberate Jerusalem and the land of Israel at the time of the end. That's the point at which the hearts of Israel will begin to turn. And Elijah will continue the work that he started in Kings. Now, the work of restoration is massive. Come with me to Zechariah and chapter 12. We know very well from the prophets, Jeremiah and Ezekiel, that the Jews everywhere will eventually return to their homeland. But Judah, of course, first, because Judah are symbolically in the land at the moment and will be there, the first to be there when Christ and the saints first march. Zechariah 12 and verse 7. Yahweh also shall save the tents of Judah first, and the glory of the house of David, and the glory of the inhabitants of Jerusalem. do not magnify themselves against Judah. This is the day when all the nations will be gathered together against Jerusalem, when Jerusalem will be a burdensome stone to them. And we see in verse 6, I will make the governors of Judah like an hearth of fire among the wood, so hot you can't touch it. And like a torch of fire in a sheaf, so hot you can't touch it. And they shall devour all the people round about on the right and on the left, and Jerusalem shall be inhabited again in her own place, even in Jerusalem. So those that try and interfere with Jerusalem in that day are going to find it a hot coal. They're not going to be able to touch it as Yahweh defends Jerusalem and the tents of Judah first. I want you to keep a marker here in Zechariah, because we're coming back here in a moment. There's another reference on the slide there in Joel. Yahweh shall roar out of Zion and utter his voice from Jerusalem, and the heavens and the earth shall shake. But Yahweh will be the hope of his people, the strength of the children of Israel. So that's Yahweh and the saints in Jerusalem, saving the Jews that are there at the time. But after that, we have the whole house of Israel. And we're going to go to Ezekiel 36. But on the way, we're just going to quote Jeremiah 30. For I am with thee, saith Yahweh, to save thee, though I make a full end of all nations whither I have scattered thee. Yet will I not make a full end of thee. I will correct thee in measure and will not leave thee altogether unpunished. Familiar words that we have this punishment of God's people and the restoration that will follow. Now we're in Ezekiel 36 then, and we're going to read at verse 21. But I had pity for mine holy name, which the house of Israel had profaned among the heathen, whither they went. Therefore, say unto the house of Israel, thus saith the Lord Yahweh, I do not this for your sakes, O house of Israel, but for mine holy name's sake, which ye have profaned among the heathen, whither ye went. Verse 24, for I will take you from among the heathen, from the nations, and gather you out of all countries, and will bring you into your own land. That hasn't happened yet. Then will I sprinkle clean water upon you, and ye shall be clean from all your filthiness, and from all your idols will I cleanse you. And I will give you a new heart, and a new spirit, and will put within you, and I will take away the stony heart out of your flesh, and I will give you an heart of flesh. So these are some of the problems that were in Malachi's day, with the idolatry and with the problems of their stony heart that wouldn't respond. Elijah is going to turn their hearts. There's a clue in the prophets as to what's going to happen when the work of Elijah starts. There will be a change in their heart. Now this chapter is followed in chapter 37 by the vision of the Valley of Dry Bones and the whole house of Israel, verse 11. That's all 12 tribes. The whole house of Israel has a body, has life breathed into it. Judah and Ephraim, a stick for each of them, joined together in verse 19. And what does that mean? In verse 21 of chapter 37. And say unto them, thus saith the Lord Yahweh, behold, I will take the children of Israel from among the nations whither they be gone, and will gather them on every side and bring them into their own land, and I will make them one nation in the land upon the mountains of Israel, and one king shall be king to them all. And they shall be no more two nations, neither shall they be divided into two kingdoms any more at all. It's clear, it's simple to understand. The whole of Israel is going to be returned to their land, and one king will reign over them. And that king, of course, is Christ, which is spoken of at the end of this chapter in the name of the seed of David. So how is this going to happen? How are Israel going to get back into their land? How are their hearts going to be turned? Well, let's remember there will be Jews in the land at the time of the Gogian invasion. Some will be destroyed, some will survive. And we can't say that the Jews in the land today are only those of Judah, Benjamin, or Simeon, that southern kingdom. That in truth, the Jews in the land today are a mixture. And the Jews spread throughout the world are a mixture too. But the Jews in the land today are symbolically representative of Judah. And they will be converted. Come back to Zechariah and chapter 13 and verse 7. Awake, O sword, against my shepherd and against the man that is my fellow, saith Yahweh of hosts. Smite the shepherd and the sheep shall be scattered, and I will turn mine hand upon the little ones. And it shall come to pass that in all the land, saith Yahweh, two parts therein shall be cut off and die, and the third shall be left therein. And I will bring the third part through the fire and will refine them as silver is refined, and will try them as gold is tried. And they shall call on my name, and I will hear them. I will say, it is my people, and they shall say, Yahweh is my God. So there's going to be some difficulties for the people, the Jews, the people of Israel that are in the land at the time of the northern invader. Some will be destroyed. There will be a time of trouble for them. And it says here that they were brought through the fire and refined as silver is refined and try them as gold is tried. We can't read those words without thinking about faith. The trial of your faith being much more precious than gold that perisheth, though it be tried with the fire. The just shall live by faith. We walk by faith, not by sight. Faith must be seen before the appearing of the anointed, otherwise it's not faith. Is this the start of Elijah's work? That's a subject for discussion. Let's remind ourselves of what's going to happen at the return of Christ. Christ returns and the resurrection takes place. Call to judgment at Sinai, the marriage of the Lamb. Elijah then begins his work of restoration, of turning the heart of the disobedient to the wisdom of the just. And that might include Judah first. Gog moves against Israel and Egypt. Christ and the saints march towards the land. Arab descendants of Abraham receive them, the tents of Midian and Cushan. Gog then destroyed on the outskirts of the land and on the east of Jordan, typified by the utter destruction of Sihon, king of Eshbon, and Og, king of Bashan, as seen in Numbers 21. Christ and the saints cross Jordan and go into the land to liberate Jerusalem, as seen in Joshua 10 and verse 12, and the slaying of the five kings of the Amorites, led by the king of Jerusalem at that time. Christ and the saints enter Jerusalem in Zechariah. Great trouble in the world then, a time of trouble such as never was spoken of in Daniel. A proclamation then for the Jews everywhere to return. A second exodus, which has been working in the background as Elijah has been doing his work, going through the process of re-educating scattered Israel. And over time, they return as they journey back to the land. And then perhaps a period of 40 years to restore Israel fully back to their land. And maybe a whole jubilee to the dedication of the temple. Now we can debate the order of these things. They all have a scriptural reference on this slide, which you can look at. This is influenced by some of the views that are established in the Brotherhood. There is no absolute list anywhere in the scriptures that gives us everything in order. So please take this as a suggestion as for the events that will happen when Christ returns and the kingdom established and a reign of 1,000 years begins. So the work of restoration is truly great when you consider the state of the nation that we've been reading of in Malachi. Idolatry had turned their hearts away from Yahweh, together with their self-deceit and their indulgence in their own ways. But the reintroduction of true worship will turn their hearts back. They will be regathered. They will manifest faith. Their rebels will be purged, and a new invigorated nation, the seed of Abraham, will travel back to the land through Egypt to settle, not only in the land of their fathers, but in the presence of their fathers too. They'll be brought back into covenant relationship with Yahweh. What makes us so sure that this is the work of Elijah himself and not a John Baptist type of figure? Someone who comes in the spirit and power of Elijah, as Elijah came in Kings. Well, we need to have a look at the mortal life of Elijah and see how it was a preparation for the work that was to come. Come back with me to the 1st of Kings and chapter 17, where we go into the world of Elisha when he suddenly appears on the scene as an adult. We know little of his childhood, a little like John the Baptist, who was in the deserts, in the wilderness, until his appearing unto Israel. 1 Kings chapter 17. And we'll see now that Elijah's life was a preparation for the work that lies ahead for him, as our lives now are a preparation for us and our work in the kingdom. Now, we know from James that Elijah had prayed for there to be no rain, but there's no reference of that in chapter 17. We arrive in a drought in verse 1 of chapter 17. Elijah the Tishbite, that's the first mention of him, who was of the inhabitants of Gilead, said unto Ahab, "As Yahweh, God of Israel, liveth, before whom I stand, there shall not be dew nor rain these years, but according to my word." 3 years and 6 months there was no rain. An interesting time period. It's 42 months. It's 1,260 days. In Revelation 11, verse 3, it represents a period of dominion over the ecclesia by the idolatrous Roman system. And idolatry was in prevalence here in Israel in the days of Elijah and the reign of Ahab. So here then in Kings we see idolatrous Israel in the supremacy being punished by a curse of no rain upon the earth. Elijah was fed by the ravens, the unclean birds. Why was he fed by the unclean birds? Because he was about to go and preach to a Gentile. And that happened to Peter, didn't it, in the Acts, when he saw the animals on a sheet. And he then went to the Gentiles. And he's prepared for that. And he moved to Zarephath, up in Lebanon, in Zidon, to the widow, who displays the ultimate faith by giving Elijah the last food that she and her son had. And she was rewarded with salvation in type, as the cruse of oil did not run dry. And when her son sadly died, Elijah was there. He was there to breathe life into that boy. An echo, maybe, of the breathing of life in Ezekiel 37, when the dead body had breath put back into it, because Elijah's work is to revitalize. Now, the faith of this woman was a lesson and a principle for Israel to see, because Jesus goes back to it when he said, "No prophet is accepted in his own country, but I tell you of a truth, many widows were in Israel in the days of Elijah, when the heaven was shut up 3 years and 6 months, when great famine was throughout the land, but unto none of them was Elijah sent, save unto Zarephath, a city of Zidon, unto a woman that was a widow." Zidon, the hometown or the home country of Jezebel. In chapter 18 of the 1st of Kings, the end of the drought is coming, and there's a time limitation to this of 1,260 days, so Elijah has to act, because he's got to get this in, and he takes the prophets of Baal to Carmel. Carmel means a fruitful field. It gets interesting here as Elijah tries to turn the hearts of the disobedient to the wisdom of the just. The truth has been suppressed by the idolatrous system headed up by Jezebel. The true prophets of Yahweh had come together because times were tough. They'd been hiding in a cave and Obadiah had been feeding them in verse 4. These were difficult times. And as Elijah and Ahab meet, a very interesting phrase is used in verse 17 of chapter 18. It came to pass when Ahab saw Elijah that Ahab said unto him, "Art thou he that troubleth Israel?" This is Achor, the troubler, as it was Achan in the battle of Ai, he that troubled Israel. And there is a cruel irony that Ahab is the one that suggests Elijah is the one that's troubling Israel, when it was his marriage with Jezebel that was causing all of the problems. So how does he try to turn them on Mount Carmel? Verse 21, what does he do? Verse 21, he says, "How long halt ye between two opinions? If Yahweh be God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him." And the people answered him not a word. There was silence. Silence on Mount Carmel as Elijah was speaking to them. What does he do in verse 30? He repaired the altar of Yahweh that was broken down. He took 12 stones, the whole house of Israel. 12 stones, according to the number of the sons of Jacob, whom the word of Yahweh came, saying, "Israel shall be thy name." So this is the whole house of Israel being reassembled around the altar. The trench is filled with seed, and he puts the wood in order in verse 33. He put the wood in order. Why did he do that? In all of all that's going on Mount Carmel and the stress of what had been happening with the worshippers of Baal and their frenzied activity, he takes time to set the wood in order. Verse 33, "Put the wood in order and cut the bullock in pieces and laid him on the wood and said, 'Fill 4 barrels of water.'" There are no shortcuts in the way we worship our God. And we come back to some points that we've made before. Arranging, setting in order, means arranging with care for a purpose. It's what Abraham did in offering Isaac. He laid the wood in order. In Leviticus 1, the sons of Aaron, the priests, shall put fire upon the altar and lay the wood in order upon the fire. These words aren't here just to fill space. They're teaching us something. The Proverbs, according to Ecclesiastes 12, verse 9, were set in order. Important lesson for us. We can't be random or disheveled. We can't be disorganized or casual. We set ourselves in order when we serve Yahweh our God. 12 barrels of water then, they poured upon on the seed. The seed was watered, if you were, around the base of the altar. And then fire comes down from heaven. And Elijah says in verse 36, just look at these words. Verse 36, "It came to pass at the time of the offering of the evening sacrifice that Elijah the prophet came near and said, 'Yahweh, God of Abraham, Isaac, and of Israel, let it be known this day that thou art God in Israel, that I am thy servant, and that I have done all these things at thy word. Hear me, O Yahweh, hear me, that this people may know that thou art Yahweh God, and that thou hast turned their hearts back again.'" He was trying to do it in his day, turning the hearts of the disobedient to the wisdom of the just. And then the fire came down. And what did the people say? They said, "Yahweh, he is God. Yahweh, he is God." And that's Elijah. That's what it means. Yahweh is God. Elijah then runs before the king's chariot back to Jezreel. 25 miles he ran a marathon, and he beat the king's chariot to show in type he was the forerunner. So Elijah lamented the state of the nation. He pleaded with Yahweh at Horeb because he was given to understand there were 7,000 who had not bowed the knee to Baal. And so he realized his work was only just beginning. It goes on to see the king in chapter 20 and the defeat of the Syrians. And Ahab should have destroyed them utterly, but he didn't. He just beat them and let them go. And then Elijah witnesses the appalling circumstances on which Naboth's vineyard is taken from him. And then suddenly, Elijah is taken in a whirlwind in the middle of his work. But he will return to continue his unfinished business. How do we know it will be him? Come back to Zechariah and chapter 10 as we start to bring our thoughts to a close. Zechariah and chapter 10. Verse 1. Ask ye of Yahweh rain in the time of the latter rain. So we're with Elijah in our minds immediately. We're with Elijah in our minds immediately. Verse 2, for the idols have spoken vanity, and the diviners have seen a lie, and they have told false dreams, they comfort in vain. Therefore they went their way as a flock. Here we have the idols of the days of Elijah. Verse 6 of this chapter. I will strengthen the house of Judah. I will save the house of Joseph. I will bring them again to place them. For I have mercy upon them. And they shall be as though I had not cast them off. For I am Yahweh their God and will hear them. And they of Ephraim shall be like a mighty man, and their heart shall rejoice as though as through wine, and their children shall see it and be glad, and their heart shall rejoice in Yahweh. So this is speaking of a time of restoration. And I will bring them. Oh, verse 9, sorry. I will sow them among the people, and they shall remember me in far countries, and they shall live with their children and turn again. Now, sow there is the word Jezreel. That's what it means, to sow. And we've got a number of echoes here in this chapter about the work and the time of Elijah. We're out of time, brothers and sisters, so we're going to bring our thoughts right towards a close in Hosea and chapter 2, because we said that we would see within the prophets the work of Elijah woven into what they say. Hosea 2 and verse 2. Plead with your mother, for she is not my wife. Now, Hosea prophesied in the reign of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. So a few generations after Elijah and Ahab. And he's depicting in his life how Israel had gone away and fallen away in whoredom. Plead with your mother, for she is not my wife, neither am I her husband. Let her therefore put away her whoredoms out of her sight and her adulteries from between her breasts, lest I strip her naked and set her as in the day that she was born and make her as a wilderness and set her like a dry land and slay her with thirst. Here's the drought immediately. We're with Elijah in Kings. Verse 13, I will visit her upon her the days of Balaam. It was on the top of Mount Carmel now, we're thinking, wherein she burned incense to them, and she decked herself with her earrings and her jewels, and went after her lovers and forgat me. Therefore, verse 14, will I allure her and bring her into the wilderness, and speak comfortably unto her, and I will give her vineyards, Naboth's vineyard, from thence, and the valley of Achor, the troubler in Israel, for a door of hope. The work of Elijah is seen here in the prophets. It shall be in that day, that verse 16, that Yahweh, that thou shalt call me Ishi, and thou shalt call me no more Baal, for I will take away the names of Baal. And in that day, verse 18, will I make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field and the fowls of heaven and the creeping things of the ground. The unclean animals are there as well. Elijah was fed by the ravens. I will break the bow and the sword and the battle out of the earth and will make them to lie down safely. And I will betroth thee unto me forever. I will betroth thee unto me in righteousness. This is the turning of the heart. And in judgment and in loving kindness and in mercies. And I will betroth thee unto me in faithfulness. And thou shalt know Yahweh. So here is the work of Elijah woven into the prophets, speaking of the restoration of Israel. And so the work of Elijah in Kings was a training ground and a preparation for that which lay ahead. And we must consider ourselves also to be living in a time when we are preparing for our work in the future to come. And so the purpose of Yahweh is concluded in Malachi. It is to fill his earth with his glory, back in Genesis. He punished the wickedness of sin in Eden, and the earth was cursed. He sanctified himself, his chosen people, Abraham's family, but he disciplined them and corrected them in measure, which brought an offer of salvation to the Gentiles. And then he regathers and assembles his chosen people, Abraham's family, through Christ. And through the work of Elijah, a curse is averted, the wicked are punished, and the restoration to fill this earth with his glory as the waters cover the sea. We must learn the lesson of Israel of old, my dear brethren and sisters and young people. It's here for our learning. Holiness and reverence. We must set the wood in order in our lives, in our daily lives, and sow the seed of the word and water. And our lives will ascend as a sweet-smelling savour, a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, on his terms, which is our reasonable service. Thank you.